Morning, Hannah, too. Can you hear me? Morning, everyone.
Morning, sir.
Okay, welcome. I hope you had a nice weekend.
We thank God. We are back again.
Okay. So this morning we're starting with a little pool or a little quiz.
Okay.
It's just a quick question to get your feedback about last week's lectures. I think you may have seen that on Zoom. It's probably popped up a box asking you for your feedback.
Not yet, sir. I did not see it.
Okay. Are you working from a laptop or a mobile device?
I'm using a laptop.
Okay, you might have a window that shows up on your screen separate from the Zoom screen itself. Maybe if you exit full screen. Or let me even stop sharing so
Okay.
that may help. You might find it now.
No, sir. I'm not even using full screen, but I don't see that window, sir.
Okay. At the bottom of your Zoom screen, do you see anything like pools?
No, sir.
Okay, no problem. I think if everyone doesn't participate, it's okay.
Because here I only see these few options like mute, start video, participant, share screen, chats, and in more, I only see disable video receiving. That's all I can see.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, sir.
Okay. So we'll give colleagues a few more minutes to join us.
Okay, sir.
So what do we do? Do we start soon? Class rep, are you here? Yes. Okay. Miss
Yes,
Obey,
good morning, sir.
good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, I sent an email a few minutes ago with the PDF presentation.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen it?
I saw a link. Okay, I didn't go down. I'll share it now.
Okay. I still don't have permission to send messages to the class list. I hope the address I have for the class list is correct.
Yes, it's correct.
Okay. Okay, I see we're still missing a couple of people. But I guess they will join us. So maybe we will start with the classes and then people will join us. Is that okay? Okay, I will end the poll here. Okay. So good morning, Ms. Effiong. Good morning, everyone. I'm welcoming you to the second week of classes. Last week we focused our attention on hardware. So we looked at the kinds of techniques you can use for improving performance on computer hardware in general. We did not really go into details. We did not sort of look at things like prefetching and stuff like that. But we saw briefly the role the cache plays, or the role the internal cache on a CPU has played in improving the performance, especially when you consider the evolution from the Pentium processors till date. One of the things we did not look at for lack of time was also things like schedulers. Okay. Scheduling is quite important in computer science because it allows you to make good use of resources. Schedulers are fundamental for many things, especially when you are looking at distributed computing. So I hope you may have had some other consideration during your classes on distributed computing that will cover that. This week, we are going to focus our attention more on the software side of things. And we will start this morning by looking at or carrying out a brief introduction to C language or C programming, as well as a bit of the anatomy of running things on the HPC cluster. I hope you've all been able to carry out most of the exercises in the usage manual on the cluster. I think the main cluster that was available over the weekend would have been the one from the East African Institute of Fundamental Research. The AUST cluster hopefully will be on this morning, and you can also carry out some exercises on it later on in the day. So this particular lessons or this particular lecture is divided into four parts: the brief introduction to C language, then we shall look at a bit about memory, especially the performance of memory when working with data. And then we shall look at several parallel programming models and a bit about how to design parallel programs, where we'll look at things like decomposition, communication patterns, and synchronization. And hopefully we shall conclude by implementing several mathematical algorithms, okay, in parallel, looking at how to carry out or how to implement some mathematical algorithms in parallel. Okay, if there are questions or let's say if there are comments about last week's lecture, please feel free to also write in the chat. If there's anything you want me to briefly cover before we move on, please put an entry in the chat or activate your microphone and say something. We shall just briefly give a couple of seconds for that, maybe 10 to 15 seconds, so people can do that. Okay, and based on the results of the poll, I see that a majority of the people found the lectures from last week to be very good. And I hope you will also enjoy this week's lecture. My intention this week is to try and make you, if you have programmed before, is to try and introduce you to a new style of programming. If you are not really a fan of programming, is to sort of introduce you to C language programming and hopefully get you excited about parallel programming, as well as mathematics or implementing some mathematical algorithms in programming. So I'm hoping you will also find this set of lectures quite interesting. I hope you will also take the time out before the end of the day to submit the homework from last week. We shall be getting to the second homework later on today or later tomorrow. So this set of slides providing a very, very brief and fast introduction to C programming is based on a PDF document that comes from Stanford University. I think it's probably one of their entry-level courses on C programming, but they provide this PDF, which is about 45 pages. I think it's brief enough and covers all the basic essentials to get one started. Of course, there are many books on C programming you can find, and some of them running into, I will say, hundreds of pages. It's very easy to write a lot about the C program or the C programming language. C, as we know it, the language C was developed by a gentleman by the name of Dennis Ritchie at the AT&T Research Laboratories, Bell and AT&T Research Laboratories. I think it was about 1972. And his main task or his main objective was to design a language that could be used for writing operating systems. Of course, as you can imagine, before the C language, there was another language called the B language developed by a different gentleman. I think maybe that was Martin Richards, if I'm not mistaken. But C quickly grew in popularity. C may have been based or was based on some parts of the B language as well, but it quickly grew in popularity and it's considered a tool for professional programmers, mainly because it allows direct access to hardware. So C sort of focuses on getting out of the way and allowing the programmer to do whatever he wants to do, either with hardware or with memory. And so it's quite versatile and flexible. You can equally write a C program to work with the mouse, or you can write a C program to do fancy things with graphics on the output display screen, or you can write a C program to churn some numbers or carry out various styles of programming or different kinds of programming hardware. It was also built with portability in mind. So the key idea is that you can equally write a C program for a handheld microcomputer to a mainframe or a mini computer, or a supercomputer, or a desktop computer, or a laptop computer. It was built with that in mind. And one of the fundamental premises of C is that the programmer is the king. So the programmer is responsible for many things, including memory management. There's nothing like automatic garbage collection. if you create garbage, you have to collect the garbage yourself. Okay. And so it's quite interesting, but the programmer tends to be in charge of everything. Having said that, it's equally simple and fast. So if there are several ways of doing things, C focuses on allowing you to do things only in one way. Okay, it's quite minimal in style. So there are not very many, there's not 1,001 different keywords and syntaxes for arriving at the same target. Okay, so it just does the bare minimum and then allows you to do things, build on this bare minimum to do all kinds of things you want. This minimalism could be a weak point for beginners because it means that it's very easy to introduce errors. There are not very many things that protect you from introducing errors. So debugging a C program is always an essential step, and it's a way, or it's also something that discourages beginners. But once you get used to it, or once you get familiar with it, you realize that it's powerful enough for you to stick with it. And I guess this is why it has survived since 1972. It's climbing on 50 years. So probably in another couple of years, the C language is going to be about 50 years. Okay, if there are comments or anything you want me to also provide some input about, feel free to also indicate. Okay, we'll simply jump in at one of the, let's say, strong points of C, which are the types. Okay. In particular, we'll focus on numerical types because that's what we'll use a lot with respect to scientific programs. C was designed to be quite portable, and so it supports several different types of numbers. So there is the character, which is at least 8 bits. There's the short integer, which is at least 16 bits. There's the integer, which can be 16 bits or 32 bits. It's typically defined as the most comfortable size on the platform. Okay, so one is not sure whether it's 16 or 32. A lot depends on the particular CPU that is in that computer. There's the long integer, which is defined as at least 32 bits. And then to make matters worse, there's also a concept called the signed and unsigned of the above different types of integers. There's also the floating point numbers. The default in C when using floating point numbers is for double precision. Double precision gives you about 15 digits after the decimal points, while single precision gives you about 6 digits after the decimal points. Although C was designed with portability in mind, you'll quickly realize that the fact that, I think one of the key features of this possibility is the idea that they only define the lower limits. They do not define the upper limits. Okay, so for character, at least 8 bits. But you'll quickly discover that this changes depending on the architecture you are on. If you're on the 86 processors, you're going to be looking at 8 bits. If you're on the x86, which tend to be 64-bit processors, you'll find that things change. This is also different if you move to a platform that uses the Itanium processors, which were supposed to be super powerful and very expensive. Okay, so things are not well defined, and then sometimes you may find that to make your program really portable, you might need to specify your own data types. So C does allow you to define your own data types, So you might as well set up integer 16, integer 32, and then so on and so forth, or integer 64, as you will. So that you avoid this confusion that is introduced by portability, or the fact that C just focuses on lower limits. Okay, so what do we have with respect to numerical limits in C? So the signed characters tend to be the default, and the character limit holds numbers from minus 128 to plus 127. Or if you are looking at the unsigned version of characters, you are going from 0 to plus 255. So signed allows you to keep store both negative and positive numbers, whereas unsigned allows you to store only positive numbers. So for the short integer, you can see that signed will go from minus 32,768 to 32,767. Or if you're unsigned, it goes from 0 to 65535. And so for the integer, you find that those are the values, okay? And then you have the long integer. So you find that this is where our troubles really start. So long integer, you can have two types. On 32-bit hardware, it goes from those values to those values. You see that on 32-bit hardware, it's exactly the same as your integer. Okay, or on 32-bit hardware, your integer may have the same values as the short integer. Okay, and then the long integer on 64-bit hardware goes from some very large numbers. I've decided to use the equation so you understand how these limits are derived. So for the long integer, we see that it's essentially 2 raised to the power 64 divided by 2. The negative value of that 2 raised to the power 64 divided by 2 minus 1 for the positive value. Or if we're looking at the unsigned, it's simply from 0 to 2 raised to the power 64 minus 1. When you code, you can ask C, or you can specify to C that a particular numerical value should be treated as a long value simply by adding a suffix to that number with an L. So for example, if I wanted to specify that I'm trying to assign a value 65, and I need to tell the compiler and the software that, okay, 65 should not be treated as a character integer, but should be treated as a long number. I will have to specify it as 65L. Okay, so if I'm assigning num, I can use num is equal to 65L or something similar. And then there is also the long integer, okay, which has similar, maybe I made a mistake here. I should probably verify that. Maybe it should be going to 128, an exponent of 128 rather than 64. But I should verify that and get back to you. Otherwise, you can also verify from the URL that I specify there. And then floating point numbers can hold numbers as small as exponent minus 38 to plus 38. Okay, which is quite a big range. So during your last homework, I had asked you to specify to provide an answer to the simple arithmetic of 1.0 divided by 3.0 plus 1.0 divided by 3.0 plus 1.0 divided by 3.0. Is there anybody that would like to provide an answer to that? What do you have? What did you get for that?
I assumed that the fruit was truncating at percent 2. Point 2. Sorry, after 2 decimal places.
Okay, so your result was 0.99.
Yes.
So the question is, why isn't it equal to 1.0? I mean, if we're going to expand this mathematically, we should get 1.0, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so like you rightly said.
Because it's addition. It's not approximating because it's adding it. And I'm saying cut it off after 2 decimal places. So it doesn't see the rest and it holds it like that.
Okay, so you understand that it's also following the concept we know as board mass, which is it's going to carry out division before addition, right? Whereas if I was going to expand this equation, I will simply expand the addition before I carry out the division. So if I'm going to expand the addition, I will get something like 1.0 plus 1.0 plus 1.0 divided by 3.0. Okay, in which case, if I then do that, I then have 3.0 divided by 3.0, which will give me 1.0, right?
Yes, but that is not what I...
Yes, so the computer actually has its own precedence. So in this situation, it's going to give precedence to division. So divisions and multiplications come before additions and subtraction. Okay, so in this state, an alternative way will have been to say I could write it as 1.0 plus 1.0 plus 1.0, then put this in parentheses before I do the division by 3.0. Does that make sense? Okay, the key concept is that because of the way
numbers... Can you call me that explanation again?
Okay, yes, let me probably stop sharing screen. Let me share screen, but sort of start up a different tool to show this. Okay. Okay, so basically what we have is braces 1.0 divided by 3.0 plus 1.0. 0 plus 1.0 divided by 3.0. Can we all see this?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm saying that because of the concept, I don't know if you've heard of this, board mass. Yeah. Probably something you may have learned from secondary school. Okay, but it basically says that in mathematics, we should follow brackets, division, multiplication, addition, subtraction. Okay, so the preference is to do divisions before multiplications, then additions, and then followed by additions and subtractions. So essentially, in this case, we see the computer is going to evaluate 1.0 divided by 3.0. then store the results. Okay, my braces are on the outside. It stores these results. So let's say this is 0.33. Okay, we can, in principle, we can actually go something like this, yeah? And then it's going to do this three times. So it ends up with 0.333 plus 0.333 plus 0.333. And this is going to be 0.99999. Never arrives at one. Okay, so alternatively, if I ask him to do this, okay, this should evaluate to, and hey, we get 1.0. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if we were doing it mathematically, I mean, the basic idea is that as a human being, if I see something like this, 1.0 divided by 3.0 plus 1.0 divided by 3.0. So 1.0 divided by 3.0. I can immediately switch over to trying to use something we call LCM or something like that. So we can expand this to be 1.0 plus 1.0 plus 1.0. Divided by 3.0. So I look for the common factor amongst all the divisions. Okay, so I don't carry out evaluations immediately, but I sort of try and do groupings to simplify. Okay, and my simplification is going to arrive at more or less this. Okay, before the final step, I carry out my evaluation. Why do we do this as human beings, or why is it recommended that in maths we do this kind of groupings and simplifications first? To avoid loss of accuracy. Okay, so by doing this, I don't lose accuracy. Okay, whereas if you look at the evaluation where I carried out this part first, and then this part first, second, and then this part third, before I now did the final addition, which is this, I end up losing accuracy. So I get a value that is not as accurate as would have been if I simply simplified before carrying out the division. So each time we have to carry out a calculation, we can lose accuracy if we are not careful. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we go back to our presentation.
Yes, sir, please, I have a question, sir.
Is it doing the division, the 0.99, or doing the division first, or doing the addition?
Okay, what do you understand by board mass?
The division, multiplication, addition, and subtraction. Then you said computer will do the other way around, will divide first, which is 0.33, then add, that will be 0.99. So that's what the computer will do. Well, so human beings
computer,
will
do, the computer implements board mass.
Okay. Human beings do the other way, the LCM.
Yes, human beings tend to simplify, or we have been taught in mathematics to simplify, simply to avoid this loss of accuracy.
Okay, so getting the one is more accurate than the computer 0.99.
Yes. The computer will give you 0.99 because it logically proceeds with board mass. Okay?
Yes, sir. Okay, sir.
I believe Emmanuel had a question.
Sorry, sir. I didn't get the last part.
Okay. The last part simply says that computers are programmed based on logic. And the logic is for board mass instead of simplifying first. So as soon as a computer meets a calculation, it evaluates that calculation based on board mass. It doesn't have the concept of simplifying that equation before performing a computation. Do you understand me now? So essentially what I'm trying to say is that the computer will evaluate 1.0 divided by 3.0. It goes from left
hand side to
the right. Yes, please.
The long int, does it go in relation to like, does it have like a 32-bit long int and it's 64-bit long bit, or is it just long int for any form of computer, 32-bit and 64-bit?
I believe the long int will have 64 bits and 132-bit version. Sorry, yeah, 128-bit version. Okay. So it starts from minimum of 64 bits. Okay. My intention is just to show you some of the confusion that exists in C language, especially when working with numbers. Okay. Right. But this confusion arises because C as a language says we define the lower limits for the numerical data types. We don't define the upper limit. So it all depends on the hardware you are working on. Of course, you will understand that the original definitions were things like character, integer, and things like long and short integer were created just to try and provide some sanity in the whole ecosystem, especially as we began to see different microprocessors. So the key challenge of using integer alone was the fact that if I'm working with a microprocessor, my integer size was different from my working with a mini computer or a mainframe computer, which was the platforms they had available in the 70s. And then eventually we started seeing, okay, we are now talking about 16-bit processors, no longer 8-bit processors, then 32-bit processors, then 64-bit processors. Itanium, which was another processor, was a 128-bit processor. So you find that there were all kinds of crazy things happening, especially with code. So if I write a software program that works, it's portable because I can compile it for 16-bit processor, I can compile it for 32-bit processor, I can compile it for 64-bit processor, or even Itanium's 128-bit processors. But the point was that my integer changed based on the platform I was on. So the capacity sort of changed, and it was difficult for the guy who is doing data analysis to really understand why. For example, if I have an 8-bit system and I'm trying to do, let's say 32,000 plus 32,000, it's going to crash simply because that platform can only work with up to 255, okay, in 8 bits. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so somebody asked a question about long. I hope you are okay with the explanation.
Yes, sir.
Okay. The truth is, the reason why we are doing this is just to also help you read some code. So if you are participating in some scientific project and they provide a code that is doing data analysis, and you have to understand why the program seems to work one way on the laptop. It seems to be giving correct results on the laptop, but when they take it to the HPC cluster, it starts crashing and giving all kinds of unpredictable results. Okay, it could be related to the size of the numerical data types that they are encountering. Okay, and then characters. Okay, I believe you are all aware of something called Unicode. Yeah, as opposed to ASCII characters. Does anybody have, can anybody sort of give us a sort of small discourse about ASCII and Unicode? Okay, ASCII stands for American Standard Code for Information Interchange. I believe we've met this because it's probably something you should have done as far back as your second level in undergraduate computer science. Okay, and it's a standard way for encoding alphanumeric characters, especially for transmission. We probably will know that computers work very well with numbers. Okay, so when I type the letter A on my keyboard, essentially what it does is to send a numeric value to the processor. Based on the numeric value, the processor will send instructions to my screen to display letter A. Does that make sense? So the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, if you look at the first letters, American, A, Standard, S, Code, C, Information, I, Interchange, I. That's what is defined as the ASCII, A-S-C-I-I. It was designed to allow us to transfer alphanumeric characters from one computer platform to the other, okay, in a standard way. So things like your keyboard have to conform to ASCII in order for a computer to recognize that you press the letter A instead of, as opposed to the letter Q or the letter Z or the letter M. Okay, so each character had a code definition. There's a particular table that shows this. Let me see if I can find that. Clairman ASCII. Okay, ASCII characters. Okay, so there's a particular decimal number sequence that defines various things that happen between your keyboard and your screen. So when you press the delete or the backspace key, it sends code number 8, decimal number 8 or hexadecimal 08 to the system. And the system knows that the backspace key was pressed, and so it performs various action. When you press the return character, I think that's this one, code number 13. Okay, carriage return. Okay, so you find that there's definitions for almost every symbol that appears on your keyboard. The hash, the dollar, percentage, and parentheses, multiplication, addition, I believe this will be subtraction, decimal point, division, numbers, okay, relational stuff, semicolon, colon, okay, question mark, okay, and then things like your capital letters and small letters, okay, are also defined. So here we find capital letters, like your letter A is 65, your letter Z is 90, okay, letter, small letter A is 97, small letter Z is 122, okay, things like that. Okay, this is all jolly well and good, and the whole computing world survived with this until we noticed that it doesn't support languages. So you can't really use this to write in Japanese or Chinese or Yoruba or Hausa or Igbo. They contain other symbols, okay? So initial attempts were to say, okay, we can still use the ASCII character set, but we map different code sets, okay? But people found that limiting because there were some languages that had more than 255 characters. Okay, there were some languages that had more than 255 characters because working with 8 bits could only support 255, as in the limit we see here. Okay. And Unicode was then seen as a way of breaking this. So rather than using just 255, we had 16-bit Unicode was able to represent characters using 2 raised to the power 16. So it could cater for 65,535 different symbols. So we could have several variants of the letter E, all existing in one character table. So E with the hat, E with the dot, E with the symbol or under it that were useful for writing other languages. And so nowadays when you program, especially in the context of natural language processing, you tend to use Unicode. Okay, which means your characters have a much wider range to cover as opposed to just the ASCII characters. Okay, so this is not a class about natural language processing and then things like that. So we will not dwell more on this matter. Okay, so if I'm going to design an application to process text in French or Latin or Spanish or Yoruba or Hausa, okay, I have to switch to using Unicode characters as opposed to just ASCII characters, which is something completely different. Are there any questions or comments? Okay, we'll move on.
What can we say about the difference between Unicode characters and ASCII characters? Like, what's the distinguishing feature between both of them?
Let's say ASCII is part of Unicode. So the lowest part of Unicode is the ASCII character set. So the Unicode is wider than ASCII. It contains ASCII as well. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, so just some quick notes. When writing in C, every statement or executable line has to end with the semicolon character. Okay, so if you forget to place the semicolon character, you will have a lot of issues because your program may refuse to compile. And then comments, if you want to put a comment, a description or something that is human readable and that should not be evaluated by the computer, you have to place it in between four characters. There's the forward slash asterisk to open comments, and then everything in between until a corresponding asterisk forward slash is treated as comments. So it can exist between one line, or it can exist on a single line, it can exist on multiple lines, so you can spread your comments over multiple lines as you choose. Okay, the other thing to understand is that when creating variables, the names are case sensitive. So num with small letters is not the same thing as num with a capital N or a capital U or a capital M or two letters capital. The language treats them as different variables. This is also a cause of headache for beginner programmers, because in certain cases they might write it with capital letter N. In some other cases they might write it with capital letter M. Okay, so for the system they are two completely different variables. So when you are writing a program, you have to be consistent. If you are not consistent, then chances are that the program may refuse to run, saying you did not declare or define a variable. But these things are typically caught during compilation before going to execution. And then you can assign variables with values after you've declared them. So num is equal to 32 is quite easy to do. The C language also implements automatic truncations. Okay, what does this mean? If we look at the types defined here, you'll discover that the integer can hold bigger values than the short integer. And the short integer can hold bigger values than the character integer. Okay, I think probably this table is not complete for the macros. Characters you can specify with C. I think short integers with S and then integers with an I. But what happens is that when I try to assign an integer to a character, the system will simply drop the bigger portion of it and use only the lower portion to arrive at what you want to do. After all, it feels the programmer is king, so it doesn't understand that you actually made an error, but it feels you know what you are doing and you are trying to assign the contents of an integer to a character variable. The character variable will only hold the lower parts, the part it can, and throw away the other part. And the same works if you are trying to assign a float to an integer. It will simply drop the decimal point and everything afterwards and just assign the basic numerical value to the integer as long as it can. So this is also a source of errors, because you don't get any flag that it's an error. You don't get any problem at all showing up. But eventually your answers are going to be wrong because there's been a truncation happening somewhere. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. We'll move on to operators. C has a very rich set of operators. We'll not cover the basic arithmetic operators, which are the addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. C also has a special set of operators called the pre and post variations. And that's typified by the plus plus and the minus minus. In their simplest form, they are simply saying add one or subtract one. So plus plus is a shorthand for saying plus one. Okay, minus minus is a shorthand for saying minus one. Let me try and give you an example of what that happens or what happens. So assuming I have a variable a, let's define it to be an integer a. So following the C syntax, I have to say int a. That's a declaration to say that my variable a is of type integer. I can do things like a is equal to 32, right? Or let, to be consistent with our notes, we can say something like num is equal to 32. So this is assigning a value of 32 to this variable. Okay, then I can say num is equal to num plus one. This is quite clear. Everybody understands what's happening here, right? I'm adding one to the contents of num and assigning this new value to the variable of num, which is essentially saying num is going to be equal to 33. Now in C, I can also do, this is or num plus plus. In both, essentially this syntax where I use the plus plus is essentially a shorthand for saying add one to the current value of num and reassign it to num. In both cases, if I try to examine num, okay, my value is going to be 33. Similarly, I can have num is equal to num minus one or num minus minus. Okay, in both cases, num should come out to be 32. If I was 33 here and I execute either one of these statements, I will get 32. Okay, so in a sense, many times C programmers like to show off with all this shorthand. So they're just like, okay, I'm cool. I know what I'm doing. Quite cool. It's cooler to write num this, I mean to write num plus plus than to write num plus one. It's only for people who know that will realize you are simply doing num is equal to num plus one, but you saved yourself having to type the equal to sign, having to type the variable name and then plus one at the end. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we go back to our presentation. Okay, and then relational operators. So if you want to test equality, you use the double equal to sign. Okay, if you want to test greater than or equal to, use the greater than combined with the equal to sign. If you want to test less than or equal to, less than or equal to, not equal to. So exclamation equal to sign will be not equal to. And then greater than or less than. Okay. And then logical operators. So we have the not is the exclamation sign, the and. So logical and is the double ampersand signs, and logical or, the double pipe symbols. Okay, C also allows you to carry out bitwise operations. So if I want to do bitwise and, so I simply use the single ampersand symbol. If I want to do bitwise or, I use the pipe symbol. If I use the tilde, it flips all the ones to zeros. Okay, and flips all the zeros to one. So it sort of flips all the bits in the numerical number I'm working with. I can also quickly do a XOR operation simply by using the caret symbol. in the bitwise sense. Okay, and then I can shift to the right using the two greater than symbols, or I can shift to the left using the two less than symbols. Okay. Assignments, of course, we've seen the equal to sign, but C also supports some shorthands. This is add and assign, subtract and assign, multiply and assign, divide and assign. Calculate the modulus and assign. This is going to perform a shift to the right and assign, shift to the left and assign. A bitwise AND and assign, a bitwise OR and assign, a XOR operation and assign. Let's look at some examples of this to sort of clarify things. So if I say, if I want to do num is equal to num plus 5, I can simply write it as num plus equal to 5. Okay. Essentially, what I'm simply saying is that add 5 to the current value of num. In this situation, my result will be 37. And then similarly, I can do num is equal to num minus 5 or num minus equals 5, which will give me back my value of 32. Similarly, I can say num asterisk equal 2, which is saying that's the same as, or num is equal to num times 2, right? So what will be the value here? Quite right, 64. And then similarly, I can do num divided equal to 2, or num is equal to num divided by 2, which gives me back my value of 32. Okay. There is another shorthand that C proponents typically use. And it's kind of a replacement for a long if then else construct. Okay, so typically if I want to do evaluate an expression, a logical expression, then based on that logical expression, I then choose to perform one action or the other. C allows us to do this in shorthand form. I will illustrate that using this. So if I wanted to say if num is greater than 33, this is what I will do. Y is equal to 45. And then else y is equal to 22. Okay, so this is a conditional statement that simply says if the contents of num is greater than 33, then we assign the variable y to be 45 and otherwise we assign y to be 22. Let's keep C happy. We define that y is an integer. Okay. So in this case, we're assigning y based on the value of num. So the shorthand way of writing this in C will be num greater than 33, question, okay, sorry. Yes, y is equal to num greater than 33, question 45, colon 22. So essentially it's saying evaluate this expression. If it is true, take the first one here. If it is false, take the second one here. Okay, so I've saved myself having to type all these lines simply by using this tertiary construct. If facility. Okay, are there any questions? Is it clear so far? Okay.
Okay, sir. It's clear.
Okay, and then the key thing to understand is that the coily braces are always used for grouping blocks. So coily braces always group blocks of code together. You will see that if we go back to this example, even when I was using the if statements, I use coily braces to indicate what should be executed for what's positive, and coily braces to indicate what should be executed for when the expression is negative. So I can even have multi-line statements. Z is equal to 21. Or let's say A is equal to 6, something like that. So the coily braces groups the blocks together. So from this coily brace to this one here, the opening to the closing specifies the statements that will be executed when we are positive. And from this one to this one indicates what will be executed when we are negative. Okay, so many times we have to realize that when we are carrying out when we are carrying out relational operations, we have to remember to use the double equal to instead of this. Okay, I will illustrate a common source of error. So let's say float y. Okay. I can also do it this way, float x and y. Let's just go to a new page. Float x and y. So this defines two variables, y and z. Okay. So we can add x, y, z. X, y, and z. So we can say x is 3.1416. Okay, and then we can calculate y based on some other value. So let's say y is now calculated, and we are going to calculate the value of pi and 3.14679, something like that. Yeah. Okay. So essentially, perform some calculations. Guess why? Okay, are we still following? Yeah. So I want to now perform a test. I want to test if x is equal to y. Or let's even do it this way. Okay, so I want to perform a test. So I'm going to do something like if x is equal to y, z is going to be equal to 200.0. Okay, else z is 100.0. Okay. Do you have a question you want to ask? Hello? Are you asking a question? If you are not asking a question, then please try and mute your microphone. Okay, Okay, thank you for muting. Okay, so essentially I have this test here that says if X is equal to Y. So one common time is that people think that, okay, simply because it's an if statement, I can do something like this. Essentially, what you do, what you are doing here is simply an assignment. You are saying assign to X the value of Y. So for logical, I have to use X is equal to YY, right? Sorry, X is equal to Y. So this is a test. So it now says, is the value of X equal to Y? If so, assign 200 to the value of Z. Otherwise, treat Z as 100, right? So if you look at this example above, X and Y differ in the number of decimal places, okay, in the digits after the decimal places they have. Does that make sense? They are both floating point numbers. So you can see that this one has 4 digits after the decimal place, and this one has 6 digits after the decimal place. Okay? This is enough to make sure that this test always fails. So X will never be equal to Z. Sorry, never be equal to Y. And this means my code will always choose Z is equal to 100 because of the fact that this was assigned and this was calculated, and the number of decimal places after the, number of digits after the decimal place are different. So it means that this is not the same. Okay. So what does this mean? It means that when working with floating point numbers, we should avoid this test, the equality test. We have to think about other ways of trying to test the value of X and Y. Okay, or we try and round them up, okay, to a common decimal point and then find out what that is. So you might find that in certain codes, people do something like if absolute value of X minus Y is less than 0.5. Okay. So rather than doing an equality test, I can say, okay, I take the difference between both of them. And if the absolute value is less than 0.5, then I assume it's the same as they are equal, right? Of course, you are free to choose whatever precision you like here. Maybe you might want to use 0.05. It's really up to you. But that's your tolerance, okay? And then anything else will assume they are not equal. Okay, so this is a common pitfall when working with floating point numbers. Try to avoid the equality test. Okay, does anybody want me to go over that again, or you are comfortable with it? Okay. We go on. Let's take an example. You feel free to carry this out on your own, even as we are speaking now. You can log into a HPC cluster, okay, and then simply type this code we have on this side, the code on this side of the screen. You can type it into a file called hello.c, and then you can compile the code, and then you can execute it. So let me do that and simply show all of us. Is it clear? So I can SSH to okay. It's not responding. Okay, it is. Type my password and I'm logged in. It seems to be responding quite slowly. So chances are that there's probably somebody trying to run something on it, which is never a good idea. Let's see if it will give me the prompt and then we can investigate who exactly is causing these problems. So unfortunately, there are other people using this system. Let me try this. Okay, I think it looks like it's a system task. So you can see that last week during our introduction to Linux class, I showed you that I mentioned that you can use a command called top to see who is running applications on the system. So here we can see that the task that is taking a lot of CPU, the most CPU time is called NFSD. Okay, which are these ones. And that's a server task. Okay, so if I say who, let's see who's logged in. So we have a user, Sirambona, logged in 3 times. Htela is logged in 2x. Onime logged in 1x, that's me. And then root is logged in as well. So really nothing to do. Okay, so I can simply try to carry on with my task. Pico hello.c is going to behave slower. So are there any alternatives to doing this? Okay. So it says Pico is not a command. So nano, I guess, nano hello.c. Nano hello.c. It's really behaving badly. So nano hello.c. So I have a blank screen, okay, or a blank document or a blank C file, and I can type the code we had. Okay, so if we go back to our presentation, we see that the code is include stdio.h And then we can define main this way. And we open the curly braces. Okay, and inside main, I can have integer num. I assign num is equal to 32. And then I can say print hello. Print world, print okay, then I end my program. So this is exactly the same code we have in the right-hand side of this slide. Okay, then I save this file. I can use Control O to save the file. It says, do I want to save it as hello.c? I say yes. Whenever I try to exit, assuming I have made changes to my file, okay, and I try to exit using Control X, it's also going to ask me if I want to save. I can say yes, and it says, do I want to use this name? I say yes, and it's okay. So now I have a file called hello.c. So please, I think I had an error here. So this should be nano, not pico. Okay. Then since it's a C language program, I have to call a compiler to translate this code into an executable. And the C compiler is called CC. So I can specify that I want the name of the program to be hello, and then the input should be hello.c. And minus O allows me to specify the output file name or the output option. If I don't specify minus O, C will use a name called a.out. That's the default name it uses. Okay, so you see that I have a problem already. It says fatal error sdtio.h, no such file or directory. Has anybody spotted the problem here? If I go back to my source, has anybody spotted the problem? I made a typo, so you can see that I exchanged the position of T and D. So instead of TD, I use DT. So I have to go back and edit the file again, nano, and then make the correction. stdio.h, and then I can save it into hello.c and then try to compile again. Oh, sorry. Another error. What is happening here? Did I have another typo? Yes, I had another typo. Here I have printf, and I'm trying to use the print function rather than printf. So I have to go and use printf. Printf and printf. So x. Sometimes it may be that my function is defined in a different library, so I have to use a different include statement. Okay, so if I compile this, no output, it just simply gave me back my prompt. So if I do an ls, I can see that I have a file called hello.c. So this is now the executable file that contains, that has been created from the contents of this hello.c file. So the process of writing a C program can be iterative. Each time you get an error, you try to figure out if you get an error that prevents the compilation of that program, you try to figure out why you got that error. And then you make corrections and try to compile again until you get it done. Is that okay? So it's always important to try and understand what the error message is saying. So in this case, it says no such file or directory. Okay. I could start asking myself, why doesn't this file exist? But I sort of immediately realized that I had a typo, because this is a system header and a system library. Okay, that is where functions like printf are defined in. Okay, so if I want to use a system call, I need to also specify the library it's contained in. Eventually, we'll discover that there are also mathematical functions, things like sine, cosine, tangent, that are defined in a math library. So we have to include math.h if we want to use those functions. But now that I have my executable file, I can simply execute it. Okay, and I do that by saying, notice in Linux, we have to use the forward slash to separate directory from the executable. And the full stop is a way of saying the current directory. So I'm saying in the current directory, run the application called hello. And you can see that it's simply printing out hello world. Yeah. So that's typically the first C program you can write. It's very easy. It prints out a message saying, okay, you did everything okay, and then you are rewarded with the output hello world. Let's remove this executable file. And then I try to run it again. I get all kinds of errors, like there's no such file. Okay. I only have my C file. So my C file enough alone is not executable. I have to compile it. And for this, I need the compiler. I can give the compiler options saying save the compiled version, the executable version, to a name called hello. And I specify that with minus O. And hello.c. And no news is good news, and everything is okay. So if I do an ls, I have the executable again. And that should be fine. Are we all together?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's very easy to do, and I'm sure you can typically get your hands dirty trying out all kinds of simple things. So SSH, please remember that on the slides I've sent you, you had Pico here, but it should be nano hello.c, and then cc to compile with the option minus o hello, and then to execute, we specify the directory. Full stop dot stands for current directory, full stop slash current directory hello, and that will reward us with the text hello the hello world output. Okay, so there's a question below just to engage with you about this. Can you identify a way to improve the speed of this code? Can we identify how we can improve the performance of this code?
Yes, sir. If we reduce, is there any way that we can assign as well as declare at the same time? Like instead of that int num being on a single line, can't you say int num equal to 32 on one line? That's reducing the number of lines on the code. So okay, when it's time to compile, to lower the lines.
Okay. So essentially, what she's saying is that we can also reduce it this way. Okay. I'm saying int num is equal to 32. Yeah, that's fine. Anybody else has something else to add?
So I have something similar.
I think somebody was talking already. Who was the person who spoke earlier? Was that who mentioned integer num is equal to 32?
Me, sir.
Okay, so that's Efyong. Right?
Yes, sir.
Miss Efyong. Okay. Okay. So who is now speaking? Margaret or Blessing?
Blessing. I said the Prince F can be one rather than three.
Okay, good catch. So I can have a single statement that also combines all three instead of having three of them. Okay. What are the impacts of these exercises? This performance impact is really from the second modification. So rather than making three calls, rather than calling a subroutine three different times, I'm calling it just once. So it means in principle, my execution time will be lower. Does that make sense? Because if I call a subroutine, I go and execute it to print hello, then I come back, I go and execute it again to print word, then I come back, I go and execute it again to print the slash n, which is short for new line. But if I pass in all the text at the same time, I can make one single call and then I have just the overhead of one call to a function subroutine. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's save this as with a different name. Let's say faster hello.c. Save under a different name, yes. So if I do an ls start of hello, you see I have faster hello.c, hello.c, which is my original code, I haven't changed, and hello. So now I can compile faster hello.c. I use cc again, minus o faster hello.c. Okay, is that fine? Okay, so I compile, and if I look at everything I have faster hello now as an executable. Linux will try to identify executable files with green color. So faster hello and hello. Okay, so there's a very nice utility on Linux platform called file, and it tells me the type. Okay, we're having to deal with the fact that the system is still busy. So it tells me that this is a 64-bit executable, and it's designed to run on x86-64. Version 1, it uses shared libraries for GNU Linux. Oops, my battery is sort of crying out. Okay. Okay, and then if I do a file of faster hello.c, it should tell me that this is a C source file containing ASCII text, okay? So file is quite a very smart utility because it helps you identify different kinds of file. If I had a Python code, it would probably tell me that it's Python. So when you don't know what a file is, you can simply use file to figure it out. Okay. So now let's execute faster. Hello. Okay. For this, our very simple case, the impact in performance is not noticeable. But if we have to do lots of calculations and calling lots of subroutines, you'll discover that we'll have a very noticeable difference in speed. So assuming I'm calling this 1 million times, if I had to write this 1 million times as opposed to writing it out 3 million times or calling the function 3 million times, then I'll see that there's a difference in execution time between both pieces of code. Okay, are there any questions about this? If not, we will probably move on. Are we okay? Okay, so general anatomy of a C code. We have a section that is typically known as the preprocessor directives. And this is where we include various header files, or we can define constants, things that will be treated as constants throughout the application or throughout the executable. And then we can also have optional functions or subroutines. These are subroutines we define to do various things. And then we simply make sure that we enclose them in curly braces of their own. And then we must have a main function or main subroutine. This is a special subroutine that has to have the name of main. Okay. And what happens is that the compiler will set things up that the main subroutine is always the first thing called when a program starts. So if you don't have a main function, it's typically considered an error in C programming. Unless you are creating a library, then you don't need a main function. Okay, but once the program is being executed, the subroutine called main will be called, and it must call other subroutines as needed. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
I can simply illustrate this quickly, simply by nano hello.c. I can say my func1, okay, printf hello from function1, okay, and I say func2 printf okay, so here I have another typo. And notice that C is more than happy to ignore my functions and compile this code and execute it without problems. It is up to me as the programmer to identify in main function that I want to call my func1 and func2. And of course, we can put a comment, call the user defined functions. Okay. Okay.
So there's a typo in the first function call.
Okay, what's the typo?
In the function call.
Is what?
In the first function call, there is no bracket before the hello from function.
Okay, I've actually fixed that. Have you noticed? Thank you for the observation. So at least we understand that some of you have programmed in C before. Well, I guess anybody can also hear it. Okay, is that fine? So I can save this and then here I'm printing hello world and then I'm calling user defined functions. So I can exit, save and write it to hello plus functions. Right under a new name, yes. So I then CC minus O, hello plus functions, hello plus functions. Okay. It may decide that. So I'm waiting on the busy system. Okay, so no news is good news. And so I should have hello plus functions now. So why didn't it? I was expecting much more than this for output. What happened? Any ideas? So we have this function, we have this, and then so it should have printed this line and then printed this two as well. Call these two functions that will print those statements. Okay. Let me see if we're supposed to do anything special.
Sir, I think we didn't include in parentheses too.
Yeah,
for the phone call.
It looks like, yeah, you're right. So we should do this. Let's try with this. Yeah, I think, yeah. So we compile again. Okay, so now it works. So we got the first line from main, and then main called my func1, which printed this, and then called And when it came back from my func one, it called func two, which printed this. Okay. Okay, so these are very simple programs, and we can continue our presentation. Okay, so main is responsible for sequencing how the other functions are called. It's the starting point and also the main guy. Of course, other functions can also call other functions, but eventually they should all return back to main to exit the application. Okay, so general anatomy of a function or a subroutine. We have to have a name, okay? It's also in C, you can also use that name to define the type of value that is returned by that subroutine. When you don't define the type, C will assume it's an integer. So the function will return an integer. It means that when you are writing your source code, you really have to be quite specific. Otherwise, C will make assumptions on your behalf that could be wrong. And then you can specify a list of input that should be passed to your function. Okay, and this is enclosed in parentheses. And then you have, of course, the body of this function or subroutine that is enclosed within curly braces. The body tends to be made up of three or four main parts: a declaration, initialization, declaration of variables, initialization of variables, execution or of statements or code, and then termination or the return from such executions. So let's look at this. This is a more complicated program in that it's supposed to calculate Fahrenheit to Celsius. So we see that the preprocessor directives are here. We only have the main function. Okay. And then the main function defines several variables, one called far, one called Celsius, lower, upper, and step. Then we initialize variables. We say lower is equal to zero, upper is equal to this, step is equal to this. And then we assign far to be the lower value, and we start a loop. While far is less than or equal to upper, we should have Celsius is 5 times Fahrenheit minus 32 divided by 9. Okay, so we are going to do the division first, but because they are braces, it will do Fahrenheit minus 32 divided by 9, then carry out the multiplication. And then it will print out the results. Okay, and then you'll have to change the value of far. So the value of far is increased by step. Far is equal to far plus step, and then it loops back. And then when the loop condition is no longer true, it drops down here, and that's the end of this program code. I will invite you to probably try out this code on your own later on, but simply by looking at this code, can we identify anything that is wrong with this code? Do you think there's anything that is wrong with it? Any ideas? Are we together?
For the calculation of the Celsius, it's possible that the floating point value there, but we declared it as int. So.
Okay, good catch. So the calculation at this line here, Celsius is 5 times far minus 32 divided by 9. This result may come out to be a floating point number. So there might be decimal there might be digits after a decimal place. But what happens?
We declared it as int initially.
Yes, we declared it
so
as
there could
int.
Be like a truncation.
Good. So there will be a truncation and only integer values will be returned. So what this means is that we lose accuracy. So it's not a very accurate program because the output of the calculation will be rounded to an integer. And the other thing to understand is that when computers are rounding, especially in mathematics, they always round down. They never round up. Okay, so they don't have this concept of if it's above 0.5, you round up. If it's below 0.5, you round down. Does that make sense? So it's up to the programmer to determine by himself that, okay, let me add 0.5 to this value. And either I can then ask the computer to round it down. Okay. So if it's more than 0.5, of course, it means I'll get to 1. If it's below 0.5, I will always drop to 0. Okay. Does that make sense? Do we understand? You must have seen this or encountered this in programming.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So this is a better program. The key difference between this one and this one is the fact that my variables are defined using float. So they can hold floating point numbers. What does this mean? I get better accuracy from this program, but it's going to be slower. Okay. If you note, we're also doing the calculation a bit different. So I'm saying carry out this 5.0 divided by 9 first, then carry out Fahrenheit minus 32.0, and then multiply both of them together. So I perform both a division and a subtraction first, then I do a multiplication. And then, of course, I'm printing out the results. Okay. I'm going to print one decimal point here. So 6 digits with 1 place after the decimal. Okay, for Celsius. And everything else is functionally the same thing. So this is a way of improving this program. But is there any way I can make it faster? Can I also improve the speed of this program? I've improved the accuracy by changing everything to floats. But is there any way I can improve the accuracy? Sorry, I can improve the speed. Any attempts? Okay, yes. So, Margaret, I was going to say it's not a class between F. Young and I. Yeah, please go ahead.
Declaration lower step. Maybe you can declare it in one line using comma.
Okay. Declaration, but that's already in one line. That's the declaration. Float, lower, upper, and step. That's this line here.
Okay. The assignment, like lower is equal to 0. Yes.
It doesn't really make any difference because they are different values. You are almost on the right path, but it's just a subtlety. Okay. What can you say about the values of lower, upper, and step?
The declaration of the float and Celsius and lower and upper values should be all put together since they have the same data type.
Yes, they are already put together. So you can see that here, float. Can you see my cursor? Float, lower, upper, and step. So they are all put together.
Okay. So I think we should, we can just use a single value that can multiply. That can just multiply to get the others instead of declaring for three variables. Mm.
Okay. Yes, you can actually use an equation, but the point is an equation requires CPU power. So you have to make a calculation to resolve the equation. So you are not
improving the speed. Can we put the value of lower, that's zero, and upper equals to, can we put it in like an if statement? That's if lower equals to zero and upper equals to 300.
Okay, you are actually going quite far. Okay, so maybe we can mute our microphones so we. Yeah?
Okay, so I don't think there's a use of assigning this file hierarchy to lower, since lower is constant equal to zero.
Okay. okay, you are right. You can specify, you can rewrite the loop some other way, but that's not the key aspect. The key thing I wanted you to get out from this, okay, was the fact that if you look at lower, upper, and step, they are all integers. So rather than declaring them with float, okay, which is going to use more bits for holding their contents, I can declare them all as even short integers. Does that make sense? And because they are integers, it will run much faster. Because if you remember during our early class, I told you that computers, when they have to work with floating point numbers, have to do calculations to retrieve the value or to store the value. Whereas if I'm storing a short integer, it's just to dump the contents into bits and read the bits again as bytes. Okay. So by simply changing in this declaration statement, changing this to int or short int, lower, upper, step, I can improve the speed of this calculation by an order of magnitude. It becomes very appreciable when I have to do a million of these loops. Okay, if I'm using floating points and looping over the floating points, it's going to spend a bit more time than if I simply use short integers. So, of course, it means that I have to know the data types. Looking at this, I know that lower and upper have fixed values. They are constants. And then step has a constant of 20. So in a sense, that's where I am. I can simply use these ones as integers, and like your colleagues were saying, I can simply rewrite this to be in a different way. Okay, and it means I could also change Fahrenheit to integer, because if I look at the possible values of going from 0 to 300 in steps of 20, I only have integer values once again. So even far can also be declared as integer. The only thing that needs to be floating point is Celsius. So simply making these adjustments to the type of the variables, I can also gain an improvement in the performance of this application. Okay. We will now talk about doing things on the HPC cluster. So this has been more or less a very brief and then let's say whirlwind introduction to programming in C. I hope it will allow us to get to do some exercises later on, and probably some of the homework we're going to do will cover some more aspects. of this. Hopefully we will be using a bit more C language programming when, as we go along during the week, especially during our hands-on sessions. I hope we'll cover more aspects or more interesting things about the C language when we come to those lectures. Our main purpose in this class is not to really teach you C programming, but to get you comfortable with doing things in parallel. So I'm just focusing on giving us the bare minimum introduction to C language to help us get across with what we want to do. If you are already used to programming in some other language, it's not too difficult to adapt into working with C. Okay? Okay, are there any questions? Okay. So I'll move on to how to do things on the cluster. So working on the cluster, we have to log into the login node. And as you saw me do, I have to edit my file using a suitable editor. In the cluster case, it's Nano. And then I compile the application using a suitable compiler like CC. But what should happen is that we don't run directly on the login node like I've been doing. That's always a bad practice. I have to create a job script and then submit this job script to the cluster for scheduling on one of the compute nodes. Then if it's a long job that takes several hours, I can simply log out and then go and do other things and come back later, log in and retrieve my results using an editor or a viewer, a suitable viewer. Okay, that's for the batch jobs. That's the default mode we should use when working with a cluster. There's also the possibility to run interactively. Okay, so assuming the login node is quite slow, I can interactively ask for a job that would put me on one of the compute nodes where things will be faster. Then on that compute node, I carry out my editing, my compilation, and my execution. And then when I log out from the compute node, I'll then the job will then end. Okay, and then I can go back to doing other stuff. But most of the time, I want you to focus more on using the batch approach to executing of jobs because they are much more flexible. Sometimes we don't have enough node for people to take interactively nodes and then work with them. So my main focus here is just to mention to you that it's possible, but we are going to focus more on working with batch jobs, okay? Probably during one of our hands-on class, I can give a demo of interactively getting a node and then working with that.
Excuse me, okay. I have a question.
Yes, please.
Yes, sir. So when you say batch, batch giving jobs to the HPC cluster, so do you mean like submitting different jobs per person or like for different people to submit different jobs at the same time?
Either one is possible, but the key concept is submit your job and let the system decide by itself how it will be executed and which computer is going to execute it. And then it will then give you the output results. Essentially, if you've done some of the exercises in the manual we provided last week for the AUST HPC cluster, you'll discover that you were submitting jobs. So there was a task for how you can create a job script and submit a job to the cluster. I think it may have been using a wrong directive that wasn't present there, but the concept is the same. So I may also have to update the manual. I just noticed this morning that the job it was asking you to submit was not really correct. Okay. So Victor, does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Okay, so basically, how do we create a job script? The job script, or let's go back here. Okay, so yeah, this is okay, all clear. The job script is composed of three main parts. Typically, the first line, the very first line, without any space before, it has to be what is called the shebang header. And shebang is typically these two characters, the hash and the exclamation. And then it's followed by the name of an interpreter or the location of an interpreter, directory and path. Okay, so /bin/bash is a shell interpreter. So that interpreter will be used to interpret the contents of the rest of the contents of this file. And then you have another section. Of course, the hash sign is comments. It's not directly interpreted by itself, but typically ignored by the interpreter. Then you have the hash dollar, which is used to specify directives to the scheduler. So scheduler directives. On this cluster, or on both clusters, we have access to the scheduler is the Sun Grid Engine, but there are other clusters like the PBS cluster, the SLUM cluster, okay, load runner cluster, load runner scheduler. So there are various kinds of scheduling engines around. They tend to have different prefixes, which is this hash dollar sign for providing directives within your job script. So this one says directive to the scheduler -CWD, which is use the current working directory, -JY, join standard output to join standard error to standard output, and then -S, capital S /bin/bash says use the bash shell for this job. Okay, so everywhere we see hash dollar, it means we are passing an instruction to the scheduler of the cluster. Okay, this one says use the current working directory. We might as well ask him to move to a different working directory and use that for the job. And then the lines we see here, date.hello, are execution statements that will be interpreted using this interpreter specified here, or the interpreter specified here. Okay, so we can run a sequence of binaries or even other interpreters. So here I'm running a binary called date. Then I run a binary in the current working directory called hello. Then I run another binary called date. Okay, and then that's the end of my job script. And then I can then submit this job script to the cluster, and then the cluster will pick a compute node, pack off the job to it. It will be executed on that compute node, and then I can come and view the results later. Is that clear?
Then, wow, that make it better.
Yes, sir.
Come again.
Yes, sir, it's clear.
Okay, I thought somebody was asking if we can make it better. Okay, sometimes it may be possible to combine the directives into one line, but it's typically better for readability to have them on separate lines, okay? And then, of course, here you have to sort of build the sequence of executables you want it to run. You can omit date. It's not really doing anything useful here, but essentially the date command will print out the current date and time. So what this does is that it shows me the exact date and time when this job started execution. And then it runs my executable, and then date tells me when my executable finished running. So it gives me a rough estimate of how long it took to carry out the task I sent to the cluster. And then sometimes when the cluster is heavily loaded, I submit the job maybe at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then my job starts to run at 9. Maybe there were no free resources before 9 a.m. Okay, so I can actually figure that out using this dateline here. And then if my job is slower than usual, I can figure it out simply because I have a date afterwards. So maybe if I ran it yesterday and it took 20 minutes, and then when I run it today, I'm taking 40 minutes. Then I have to wonder, okay, what changed? Is it that we're running under a slower CPU? Is it that the system was also running jobs for other users at the same time and as running mine, as a compute node was being shared with other users, okay, as to when it ran mine. So doing things like this can help you identify performance bottlenecks, okay, on a cluster, when working on a cluster. So the first date allows us to identify a bottleneck between submitting a job and when the job is scheduled and deployed to an execution host. And then having a final date also allows me to estimate whether there was a slowdown, whether we are going on a slower processor or we're giving a smaller machine for the execution. Okay. Okay, are there any comments or? Okay, so the next part of our class was going to be looking at memory hierarchy and parallel programming models. But I think this is a good time for us to sort of take a break and then maybe log into the cluster and try and do some C exercises, creating job scripts and stuff like that. Does that make sense? Shall we check if the...
Yes, sir.
Let's check if the AUST cluster is up. Let me grab a new terminal. Okay, you remember the commands for logging into the AUST cluster? And that will be onime at 154. Am I right? Do you confirm this?
I think it's correct.
Okay, so that cluster is not up. Either it's not up or there's been a power outage. Because I thought the agreement was they will put it on at 8 o'clock in the morning, but the IT guy has gone. Okay, so it means we will have to use the HPC .org. Okay, it's responding a bit faster. It's responding a bit faster. Okay. And so I'm in, yeah? So I'm going to show now nanohello.c. Okay, so feel free to try and re-implement this program make your own adjustments about improving the performance, and then compile it and execute it. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so you will notice that we do not use num. Num is not used. Okay, we simply declare it, we assign a value, but we never do anything with it. So when you are comfortable with this, one task I will say that you should try and implement will be to print out the value of num as well. So we need a new printf statement that will show us the contents of the variable num. Are there any questions or comments?
I'm still trying to work on it.
Okay. Well, is everyone happy? I understand there's somebody from last year here with us. He probably doesn't have an ID to log into the cluster we're using. If you can hear me, please send me a chat, and then you can type a chat identifying yourself on the Zoom session, and I'll probably send you an ID, a login name and a password that can allow us, that can allow you carry out the exercises. So even if you don't know a lot of programming, you can actually get a lot of things done by asking Google the right questions. So for example, if I go to Google and I say, something like, how do I print integers in C language? So you see, it gives me print an integer in C language, programming simplified. Let's go there. So you can see that this is the line that will work the integer is percentage D slash N, and then I need to put the name of the variable. So with printf. Are there any questions or?
So, for the integer, the collecting the integer when we're using scanf, after writing it in the C program, and then we're running it on the SSH directly. That is the program, like when it's time to impute the number scanf in. Scanf percentage D, when we want to be input the number of the norm, like let's say we want to put in like 5 instead of 32. So when we're putting in the 32, like, is it interactive?
Yes, of course it's interactive.
Is it like, will it be like a pop-up ad, where, like a pop-up box where we then put in, or will it just come like in the same command line?
It will come in the same command line. You have to avoid doing stuff interactively when you are using the batch jobs, because it means the compute node will be stuck waiting for somebody to type something on the keyboard or type something for that program. So please avoid that. There are ways of getting around it. Okay, but you have to create an input file. Okay, and then sort of either redirect standard input to that input file in your job script. Okay, maybe we can cover this in some other class, advanced operations. But don't use a scanf here. The only task I'm asking you is just to printf. Okay?
Okay, sir.
If you know how to use a scanf, you probably also know how to pass a parameter to the application. So for those of us who haven't got it, we need printf. The number is percentage D slash N num. Sorry, not dollar, percentage. So this says we want to print out this statement. We're expecting to have in this exact location an integer variable, or the contents of an integer. And then the slash n, of course, is new line or carriage return. So it moves to a new line. And then we pass the name of the variable whose contents will be placed here to afterwards, after a comma. Okay, so printf this, and we're done. Okay, so there are only two people following the exercises, or two people trying to do the exercises. Are there any problems from the other users? Most of the others did not appear to have logged in.
So there's no problem. I'm trying to get my password back, the one you gave us that day.
It's very easy. What's your user ID? I mean, how can you forget the password? What's the user ID?
ID was 04, AST04.
Okay, so did you change the password or you?
No, I didn't change it. It was AUOE somewhere, zero, some was capital S, so I'm trying to, I was not sure.
Okay, and this is Efyong, right?
Oh, no, it's Margaret that's speaking.
Margaret, okay. So I'm going to send you a private chat. So the first and the last letter are the ones that are in capitals.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, that should be. I mean, if you have challenges, just let me know. Mm-hmm. Okay, Hannah too doesn't have electricity. Okay, so if you have challenges like you are running out of battery power or electrical power or stuff like that, or your laptop doesn't have the inbuilt battery functional, you can in principle do some of these exercises later on when you have energy, but please make sure you do them. Okay. If you have problems with the internet, what can I say? The key point is that the more we practice, the better we'll become, or the easier it will be for us to appreciate. You know that the exam will have to be sort of quite, it will require you to think. So it's not just going to be questions you can download from the internet. It will either require you to think or to be something you've done practically during the hands-on. And so if you don't do this hands-on, you stand a chance of really missing out on being able to do well during the exams. Okay. We don't formally have I didn't formally prepare a text for how you can connect from mobile devices, but maybe I should update the manual providing how you can connect from mobile devices as well as carry out some of the exercises that are there. Okay, so we have about 5 people. Sorry, 4. Okay, I think the major problem with this phone is that you have a small screen, but it's not impossible. I will try and provide an updated manual that also discusses how you can connect using the Android platform. And then once you are in, you can carry out the same exercises like using the Nano editor and stuff like that. And class rep, I'm expecting you will probably collect and provide the assignments. Either you do that, or you can you can send me your assignments by email directly. Okay. Okay. I don't know if anyone has any comments, or did you encounter any special challenges? Have you been able to compile the code, compile and execute? Is everyone following?
My own is telling me that unknown type name integer, maybe it's because it's capital letter, I think it's a small letter.
Yeah, you have to use small letters. Okay, I want to mention that it's important compiling is always going to be the same instructions we had in the slides. So to compile the code, you have to use this.
I've gotten the output, hello world. But I want to ask, if we save the file as another name, do we still, when we're compiling, do you still need to type cc-o hello, then another name.c?
Yes, the output file name of the compilation process has no relationship to the input file name. So what this means is that I can as well do cc test, cc minus o test, testing 123.exe. It doesn't mean anything. Hello.c. So I will have a new executable called testing 123. Okay, so there's no relationship to the name of your input file at all. You can also get by not even specifying it, but it's good to always specify it because then you are in control or you're in charge. If I do this, it compiles but sends the output to a file called a.out. a.out. which is a weird name. If I compile another one, so if I compile hello, you remember faster hello.c? You see, it simply overwrote the contents of a.out. Okay, if I compile hello plus functions.c, simply overwrote it again, a.out. So it's best to always specify the minus o when you are using the compilation directive or the compiler directive. So once you've logged in, things like nano, CC, and so on and so forth are no longer dependent on whether you're using PuTTY or you're using ConnectBot or you're using an SSH from a Linux machine. They're all part of standard Linux cluster environment. Okay, so if you remember very well, to get out of Nano, you have to hold down the control key and press X if you are using a PC. And then don't forget to answer the prompt. It may prompt you asking, do you want to save the file? You can answer yes, and it should save the name directly, or something similar. Okay. Okay, if you receive an error during compilation, you can, in principle, simply type the error message in the chat, and I will try to explain where the challenge might be. Was the fatal error no input file? Okay, so it basically means that your C file is not on that name, as you should check under what name you saved the C file. What's your, have you saved the C file? Alternatively, you can type the, you can place in the chat the command you were trying to use for the compilation. Okay, please note Okay, if you are following my screen here, please note that you have to always terminate the main function with, make sure that you have a matching pair for any coily brace you use. If you open a coily brace, you should have a matching pair for the coily brace. Okay. Okay, I think we can I'm probably going to leave you for today, but please go ahead and then try the other C codes you have in the presentation. So in the presentation, we have a total of 3 C codes that are present there. Okay, so there's this Hello World program, which is on this slide. Eventually go ahead and implement this example 2, which is converting from Fahrenheit to Celsius, and look at the output, see what it generates as the output. And then implement this other version of it and look at the output and see what it generates as well. Okay, so these are 3 programs you can try to type in, try them out, compile them, find them. If you have error messages, please check that you have the right syntax and you followed everything that is in the document. Of course, you can simply ignore typing things like this. Okay, it's good to use a blank line to separate your preprocessor directives from main for readability. And then in the same vein, we also have a blank line that separates the declarations of variables from the initialization of variables from the program code. It's just good programming practice for readability. Okay. Assuming there are no additional questions, I'm going to end the class for today. Is there anyone that has a question?
So I will try it out and give you feedback tomorrow.
Okay, so all the best.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, as soon as I drop the call, it's going to drop it for everyone. but we'll see you tomorrow. So enjoy the rest of the day and don't forget to practice.
Okay, sir.
Thank you.